Right. Good evening. Welcome to the LSE and to the public lecture for the Gender Institute this term. I'm sorry that we're a little late in starting. I would like to introduce to you Cher Height, who is an independent award-winning researcher and a cultural historian. She's a member of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and the American Historical Association. She's published three very well-known reports, which I know that many of you have read: the Height Report on Female Sexuality, the Height Report on Men and Male Sexuality, and Women and Love. And tonight she's come here to talk about her new book, which is the Height Report on the Family. Please. Sure.
Thank you. You don't know how nice it is to hear some applause after some of the things I've been hearing. So I'm really sorry to be late. We were doing a tape at the Late Show, and they were late. And it didn't have nothing to do with me. But anyway, and then they had a car which is supposed to, you know, when it's rush hour, and they didn't really, and they rushed, but how could they rush? I'm really sorry. How much time do I have before they, you know, before everyone, how much time do I have to speak? That's what I'd like to know. Wonderful. And well, would you like to have a discussion? I would like to hear what you have to say. So I'll speak half the time, and then we can have a discussion for the rest of the time. Is that all right? No one's disagreeing. Okay. So, what?
That's fine.
Yeah, no, somebody was shouting something. maybe better not to know what it was. Anyway. The topic of my discussion today would relate to, of course, today we must congratulate ourselves. It's the first day of Women's History Month. And so as we're now trying to change history, or have been for some time or several centuries trying to change it, we can think about that this month very productively. I personally have published four reports. This is the fourth report. It's a study of the family, in particular growing up in the family. The previous reports covered female sexuality, male sexuality, and identity, or something like that. And the third one was about how women define love, i.e. redefining female identity, since women are supposed to be basically defined in terms of giving love to people in the society, children, men, etc., anyone else who happens to be around. So. In this case, what I wanted to do was to investigate how the whole identity is given to children. It's often said that it's mother's fault if boys are growing up to be too, quote, macho, that why don't we do it differently if we don't like the result? That's a little simplistic. I think it's another form of scapegoating women. But I couldn't think of what the answer might be. That was one of the things that was on my mind in this study. Another was that when I did the Height Report on Male Sexuality some years ago, I published it in 1981, I had done research on that for 7 or 8 years. I really reported what men said, but I didn't interpret it very much because I wasn't a man, and I didn't feel that clear on why some of the things that I was finding were true. My editor, that's the only time I've had a male editor. I was happy to have one because I felt he could save me from going into some area that I didn't really feel good about. In retrospect, I'm not so sure that I shouldn't have commented, but in any case, I didn't understand the basic finding of that book. The basic finding was, well, there were many, but the basic finding was that most men don't marry the women that they are most passionately attracted to. But not only that, most men felt very proud of the fact that they didn't marry the woman they most passionately were attracted to. That I couldn't understand. They had some regrets, they would remember this, but they still were very glad that they hadn't lived with that person forever, or however long it was. So I reported it, but I didn't really understand it. In the study I did of women after that, Women and Love, women said that they also didn't, But that was for a different reason. That was because they couldn't make it work out. They wanted to, but they couldn't. In this study, I would say that the primary finding, the most important finding is, or conclusion on my part perhaps, better said, is relates to the whole discussion of boys growing up. I feel that boys are hit with two basic things during what's been called puberty that short-circuit their brains in a way and form an idea, well, I mean, we're all short-circuited, what can I say, me the first, and form a kind of relationship with women or idea of their relationship with women, which is difficult for them. The reason is, first of all, when boys are growing up, and especially at puberty or the age at which they can be reproductive, boys are told by other boys at school and also by old male relatives, television, what have you, well, you have to be a man now, and to be a man means you have to act tough, don't be like girls, don't be a sissy, don't be a wimp. And not only do you have to act tough, and, well, you have to go along with other boys who may be violent at school, don't tell on other boys, you have to kind of join the boys' group. Part of that may be proving that you are not like your mother. You have to prove to other boys that your mother can't tell you what to do. Oh, she wants me to come right home from school. Well, I won't come home right home from school. Being kind of flip in front of other boys if they're around the house, that kind of thing, making sure that you'll watch your TV program and not the one you're supposed to, etc. So bad boys are kind of the code word for getting status among other boys at school. At the same time that boys are told that they can't relate to their mother, that they're not supposed to be close to their mother in the way that they might have been when they were much younger, they're also told that their sexuality should be best focused on women. That's not to say that they wouldn't feel it anyway, but between the ages of 10 and 12, boys for the first time have the ability, for the most part, to orgasm with ejaculation. So boys have what's been known as puberty, that is sexual awakening. Boys began to think a lot about sex, masturbate a lot, look at pictures of women and men in magazines, really become quite obsessed with sex at that time. Girls are not exactly the same way. In fact, I would argue that girls, we don't have puberty in the same way that boys do. Boys have a sexual puberty, but girls have a reproductive puberty. Most girls can have orgasm much earlier. Many, many girls in my study had orgasm from as long as they can remember. They were just having them from the beginning. Reproductive ability in women has nothing to do with orgasm. After menopause, the beautiful word, we can also have orgasm, which is just as strong as orgasm during our reproductive years. So orgasm, I don't know, I seem to develop body language in this topic, don't I? anyway. Bashing the microphones. So boys becoming very, very fascinated by their ability to have this ejaculation and all of that, and also tend to show this ejaculation to other boys and, you know, share it all and things like that, which girls don't often do. boys then, having been told two things at the same time, and one is that, well, these great sexual feelings you have, of course, those will be aimed at women, to use the phrase. At the same time, you're not supposed to really like women. You're not supposed to identify with them. In fact, you're supposed to have contempt for them because they're underneath you. Boys are a special group. Boys are the upper group. Boys have to look down on girls in the playground. Boys have to differentiate themselves from girls. You should never have a girl as your best friend. If your sister tags along after you, this is horrible. You'll lose status. You can't have it. So girls are not a mark of status to be with them. Yet, you're supposed to desire them sexually. So that mixture in boys' minds, it develops into a kind of toxic sexuality in some cases. In any case, it develops into a great ambivalence about love. many women in my other reports have talked about, well, why, you know, I mean, he seems to love me. One day he'll call me, the next day he won't. Why doesn't he call me the next day? I know he really loves me. I mean, he was really passionate the night before, and I really believed him when he said, you know, wow, I'm crazy about you. But then he didn't call. Why? That's just one form of ambivalence. Many of the boys and men in my study on male sexuality had described feeling very, very uncomfortable being in love with a woman, or with a man for that matter, but being uncomfortable about it because they felt that this was being, this was dangerous because it was too much identified with that woman. She can wrap you around her little finger, all those kinds of ideas, which are dangerous. You're not supposed to let that happen. So that's really how patriarchy establishes itself. It sounds cute and funny, and it is cute and funny, but at the same time, there you have it. I don't think it's biological. People will tell you over and over, well, you see, it just keeps happening, and I'm trying not to bring up my kids that way, and it happened anyway, so therefore it must be biological. That's a popular saying now, and it's so shallow to say that because, after all, there's still television bringing them up. There's so many influences around that nobody can say that they have now moved to, you know, Robert Louis Stevenson's island somewhere and had this perfect different kind of relationship with their children. So I'm not trying to blame anybody. I'm just trying to present what it seems to me after years and years and years of agonized research, the kind of bare bones of how the system is working. So if you have a system in which, well, for lack of a better word, patriarchy is the idea that is men on top, then you have to deconstruct it and say, well, why does it have such a hold on people's minds? I don't think it makes men particularly happy. Men are told that they own the system, therefore they should like it, and therefore they shouldn't complain about it. And if any woman tells them they want to change it, that this is a terrible threat to men in the world, I don't think that's true at all. I think that based on my research, most of the boys who were going through this terrible initiation rite, which was very painful for them, didn't want to join it. They didn't want to join that group of guys out there bullying other guys, or, you know, like in one case, blinding a dog's eyes, but you were supposed to show that you could take it. You weren't supposed to get upset and cry. They didn't really want to join it, but they didn't feel they had a choice. The fact is they don't have a choice, because how could a man be so different and still fit into the world? Couldn't, really. So you got to join them or give up, so you have to join them. Of course, men have different styles of joining. Some will join and, you know, sort of really not participate and try to, you know, modify things as best they can. But other men go at it whole hog, and maybe that's... maybe they had a more painful time of it when they were young. It's possible. So, is it for me? Ah. So, yeah. So, there we have this problem of patriarchy kind of brainwashing boys, I would say. Margaret Mead was describing initiation rites for boys in Samoa. We look at that. It's easy for us to be objective and to say, well, yeah, look what they did there, and, you know, look at those primitive people out there and what they did. I think we're just as primitive doing this kind of very harsh initiation. We all know about it. We all observe it. We all say, yeah, boys taunt other boys. We see it in the schoolyard. We see it in rock videos. And yet we think, well, it's inevitable. We can't change it. Another part of this book on the family has another theme, which is democratization of the family, and that is taking up the question of whether or not we can change it, it being the system. I'm arguing there's something which is probably more controversial than the other parts of the book, and that is that if children are completely legally owned by their parents, if they have no alternative place to live or stay or go, then of course they're going to develop habits of thinking that it's not possible to change the system. So that there would be a large part of each and every one of us which would have a fatalistic kind of exhausted feeling, because if you're taught over and over again you can't run away from home because there's nowhere to run, then how could it be otherwise? Eventually you internalize that. Yeah, well, this is the this is life, this is the world, that's the way it is, and who am I to change it? I can't change it. And if I try, they'll punish me, or somebody will punish me, or they'll bring me back home. If I run away from home, I'll be a juvenile delinquent, and that's the classification, and the police will bring you back, and you might have to go to court and things like that. Certainly your parents or a parent single won't be happy, and then it's just worse, so why try? So that's basically the message that we learn. Now, if you say to me, well, what's the solution? Of course, children who are young are, you know, how can they have a choice? They have to be owned by their parents because you have to bring them up. They wouldn't be safe let on their own. Then I haven't got the answer for that. Maybe one of you will think up an answer for that eventually. But I do think it's important to notice that we're developing a personality in people, which isn't inevitable. Margaret Mead was talking also about the way children are brought up, and they have a kind of a, oh, if I remember correctly, they had a sort of a house for girls and a house for boys, and they went there on various occasions to be with each other. They were not with their parents. Perhaps we should have some kind of houses to which kids could go if they were being abused or they were being molested sexually or whatever their problem was. If they had some alternative, it might be a good idea. That's a very tentative way of thinking of solutions. But I think that if we want to try and unravel the system that we have and why it's so violent, then we have to think about these kind of things, which may sound radical, may sound silly, and all of that, and put aside ideas that trying to change the system would be silly and impossible, and remember why we think that, namely that we were brought up for 15 years to think that we couldn't change the status quo. It became internalized in us that you can't change the system, and realize that, of course, we can change the system. The final theme in the book on the family relates, of course, to girls growing up. And while there are a lot of things to say about that, that has been more analyzed by other people, so that I enjoyed doing that part, but it's perhaps not as revolutionary as the part in which I believe that men develop a negative eroticism to women because of the conjunction of this being taunted at the same time as they're developing a very strong sexual identity. But there are some interesting things to say about girls. I think that from my research, most girls don't experience, as I said before, a real sexual puberty. I think girls are just sexual from the beginning. They have a reproductive puberty. But the basic problem for girls is that in the stereotype of the family, that is in the Holy Family trio that we all know, even if you're not Catholic, which I'm not, but I grew up in a very religious family. We all have seen these images of Jesus, Mary, Joseph. I mean, they're just everywhere in the West to be seen. The problem with that is that there isn't any daughter in there. So if there's no daughter icon, then who's the girl supposed to be? So, in a way, even in this recent bashing of single mothers by some of the Tories, trying to take away funding from single mothers, I think there's an element of this. You're always an outlaw if you're a single woman. I sometimes wonder if so many women's desire, I'm not excluding myself, to have walked down the aisle, worn the white dress, you know, had the day when you get married, it relates to you'll finally become a real person in the society if you become marry the mother, if you get married. Then you become a real person because you're in that Holy Family trio. But before that, you never can be. Boys, on the other hand, get to be either Jesus, who's the rebel, and it's funny how many rock stars look like him, isn't it? You think about it. They love to wear, you know, that long hair and have that look, you know. So my grandmother used to have a picture of Jesus on the cross right inside the door, so I'm very familiar with the way that he's been depicted, you know, he's always depicted as a sort of young man who looks sort of, I don't know, he's got this lovely expression, doesn't he? And so I think, I saw it on TV the other night, on The Word, I think they had one who looked like that. Anyway, so as girls, we don't have any sort of an icon except for the mother icon. And society has profound prejudice against single women. Recent films have kind of returned to a medieval theme about single women, that is Fatal Attraction, Rising Sun. Michael Crichton has a novel. You just see it everywhere. There's a video game for kids which is extremely popular. I can't remember the name of it. And the object of the game is that there's a young blonde woman on the screen, and when you wipe out or kill that woman, then you've won the video game. You know, what great training. Wonderful. So this prejudice about single women runs very deep. Some of us in the women's movement for over 25 years have been wondering, why so much violence to women? Why erotic violence? Why is violence to women statistically so high? Why is it so often combined with supposed eroticism or supposed sexuality? I think one reason is because boys are given this double message at puberty. And another reason is because single women just don't fit into the system. No matter what age you are, it's single. You're just not in the system. You don't fit, and you should be wiped out. So it's funny when you start to look at it that way, how simple some of the things that we're seeing are. But to change that, what would be the solution? Would the solution be for us to keep on talking? I mean, as I said, this is Women's History Month. Would we just keep on talking about these things? Or would we eventually, would we face cycles of a back-to-basics backlash that would go on, and then we would make more strides, and then there would be a backlash? The women's movement became very vocal in the 19th century. Then Shulamith Firestone believes, and I agree, that Freudianism became popular as a system about when it did, because women had complained about the system. And Freudianism was a way that the system could accept and explain, in quotes, those complaints, because it would individualize the problem and say that, well, no, it isn't the system that's wrong, it's these individual crazy women, which is, of course, how they like to portray me in the press as well. So if any woman complains about the system, it must be her who's at fault. And then we can all get our Freudian armchairs out and declare what was wrong with her childhood or what was wrong with her anyway, and come to those kinds of conclusions. And then we don't have to face the problem. That worked for actually almost a century. We've had a century of individualizing these problems. But the issue of the family now has become so widespread that you can't hide it anymore. The statistics show how many people have left the traditional family, or maybe the nuclear family, or I prefer to call it the hierarchical family or the holy model family. It doesn't work for most people. And I think, as a final point, to say that the reason we're seeing this revolution in the family now, or in private life, better said, is because it's no coincidence that democracy in government was begun about 200 years ago, started by revolutions in different countries, usually not in England, but in other countries. Democracy in government has now spread to people thinking about private life. People think that they should have equal relationships with others. People think that they should try to have valid relationships with others. They shouldn't just fit into a form to please some social order. They think that they have rights, and those rights extend into their personal life. Therefore, people have been trying to transform their own lives. It's a difficult moment since we're sort of halfway there. Most people are really quite happy in their lives as opposed to the forms that they were supposed to have. And yet, when we see the images from the 1950s on television, etc., of the family, we think, oh, well, that must have been better. Too bad. I don't know why my life didn't quite fit into that. I know it should have, I must be flawed, it must be my problem. I don't think that's true. There was just as much battering of women in the home in the 1950s, just for one example. Men were the first to rebel against the family in the 1960s, before the women's movement, what became active on that issue. Men in the 1960s, I remember Rex Harrison began singing, "I've grown accustomed to her face. Oh no, what a terrible thing." He didn't want to be in love. He didn't want to get married. Whereas earlier in the century, men had liked the idea of being married, or at least said they did, in films. So then you had James Bond and Simon Templar and all these kind of male heroes, followed by movies full of men who were only single. The heroes were always single, never married. The cool guy was the single guy. So men started this rebellion against the family. I'm trying to say that I think for a century we've been rethinking our private life. It had to do with the ideas of democracy, which came to us through the idea of democracy in government, and now we're trying to put those into place in our private life. And so here we all are today, and that's, I think, a good sign that we're putting this into operation. That's a strange place at which to end the speech. However, I would now like to have time to hear what you have to say. So, thank you.
I think that Chair Height will take some questions, if anyone would like to ask a question. Yeah.
Have you done any work on the increasing number of mothers without custody or who are taking the option to leave their children with the husband, the father? How that's affecting the family, single parents?
The first part of what you said, have I done any work on what was it exactly?
Have you done any research on the increasing number of mothers without custody of their children, that the alternative situation of splitting up the household where the father keeps the children, the mother's a visiting parent, and also the one that may or may not be staying home?
I didn't do a comparative study of new kinds of families, honestly speaking, so I don't have any good statistics for you on that. I have some impressions from my research, but I think that the numbers are still so small in terms of fathers who are taking care of children, and I don't know of anybody who has really good statistics on that yet. What were you thinking? Are you working in that area?
I'm experiencing that area.
All right. Well, it's really interesting, the idea that women would have the right to leave the family. It's been an assumption, of course, that women never have the right to. The so-called men's movement sometimes says, well, yes, women are selfish, they take the children, whereas we want them. I don't think that's really, you know, an issue to argue about that. But I do think that we were told that we don't have the right to ever leave our children. And some women don't want to be with their children, and they should, I don't know exactly what the solutions are, but I think we should have options. It shouldn't just be that, once you've had them, that's it.
Yeah. Right, there's a question here from a gentleman here, and then there.
I mean, beyond the sort of male-female cut, let's say, are there any other, let's say, societal differences that you think are important in shaping our world? You don't seem to talk much about the wider politics.
Oh, well, you should read my novel, and there's the publisher up there. When will you sell the paperback rights, please? Tomorrow. Oh, good. Well, what? Oh, he said that I wasn't addressing the larger political spectrum, that I was only talking about male-female politics, although, you know, that's quite a bit to talk about, to tell you the truth. But yes, I did enjoy stretching my wings a little in this novel I have written, which is a political satire. It's about a woman who asks too many questions and gets into a lot of trouble. So people start screaming at her, and she feels quite unhappy about this. And so she and her dog fly off to heaven, where they get counsel from a lot of the sages of the past, since, well, I studied history in school, so it's kind of autobiographical in that sense. So we discuss with Lenin, Marx, Cleopatra, and various others how one should change things on Earth, or if one can. So if you want to know my larger political views, I hope you'll read it. Yeah? What is the question? Well, I think that I'm here to give a speech on something else. It would take me an awful long time to tell you all my politics, but if you could make the question more specific.
Are you a socialist?
Am I a socialist? He looks like Jesus. What?
Which I think is very interesting. The link you made between fatalism of people and the lack of democracy within the family. I think it's a very interesting point. As someone of your generation, I thought I brought my children up in a democratic framework. But I'm quite clear that I was brought up in a much less democratic framework when I was young, talking about the 60s and the 70s, we had a very clear perception that you could change the world, and there were things that we could do, and we were changing both our relationships and the wider world. My children, brought up, I hope, by a feminist, particularly by sons, can't see the problem, can't see the issue, and actually are fearful of the power of women.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, it would. Yeah, it's impossible to live. You know, we don't live in a vacuum after all. I mean, they're being influenced by all of the things that are around us, and that's the question. Then, if the things that are around us are influencing everybody, how do we get out of this circular thing that's going on? And in the novel that I referred to, actually, the two main characters are Ariadne, who's somebody sort of like myself, and then Cleopatra, who's a very modern Cleopatra. And the Ariadne character says, well, we just have to keep talking about it. And Cleopatra says, yeah, and look at all the trouble you're getting into, and you're still not getting anywhere. So why don't you just enjoy yourself, and if you're really serious, you should get an army. And that's how other people change things. Haven't you noticed that on Earth, she says. So I don't know what, I'm still talking.
Right, there are a few questions here in front.
Yeah, so they can hear.
Also, the way that fathers relate with their wives, should they relate more to the boys than they do today? Because today you get, as you said, they see each other from other boys. Well, is that going to psychologists with the same problem? It's the unusual diversification. Instead of being initiated with maybe what you call it, by every people, by the powers that are doing their now, and knowing how to, and being what they're getting more of the culture values. Isn't it almost like being afraid of being naked? That feminism sort of has pushed back the life of something to try to get to the wild man or that. But it's sort of prepared way to get to it.
Well, if I understood, I understood what you said, but to briefly tell the other people who probably couldn't hear. He's just saying that has feminism made men feel that they can't be men, and wouldn't it be nice if fathers and older generation taught boys how to be men? Is that what you mean? Yeah. Well, there's so many things to say to that. My head is really swimming. The thing is, if older men would tell younger men, help them to be men despite the culture, which tells them they have to be violent to be a real man, of course that would be a help. In my research of most fathers don't tell their sons anything. And most boys say that they imagined that other fathers told those other boys something. But even the rare boys who actually went on lots of sports events and fishing and all that with their father, which were not the majority, it was silent. Nothing was said and of a personal nature, of much of anything. So in that sense, I can understand feeling that a sort of loss of lack of closeness and relationship, and feeling that the male world is a kind of mysterious one, and what does it all mean anyway? Because if you can't be close to somebody in it, then how do you really understand it? So I wrote put the heading on the section, Growing Up Male, that called The Mysterious Meaning of the Game, meaning, you know, boys and their fathers watching the game on TV together, just trying to understand what the game is about. So that, I think, is a problem. But on the other hand, if the father would simply, you know, help the boy join the club, that wouldn't be so good, because male bonding hasn't been the problem, or men sticking together, although I agree with you that they haven't really enjoyed it very much. But men sticking together against women has kind of been the system. So, yes, men want to find it easier to talk to women. That's true, but they don't value those women more because they did talk to them. They just say, well, yeah, okay, she's there if I need to talk to somebody. But the real people that they meant, most men care about the opinion of, is other men, because they're the ones who are running the game, and therefore you have to have their esteem to be in the game, and it's true for us as women too. So that's a cycle that needs to be broken. I don't think that feminism is keeping... Yes, feminism would like to stop the old ideas of masculinity, that's true. But I think there certainly must be thousands of ways that men could express themselves. There doesn't have to be only just this one way. I'm sure that you would agree with that, probably.
Right, we've got hundreds of questions here, and then there, and then Sylvia, and then I'll move to the others.
Okay.
Within the terms of what you
said... Loud, 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 so I don't have to say it again.
Within the terms of what you just said, to me it seems an analysis of American sexual stereotypes and a traditional American stereotype, because the European sex roles and sex stereotypes are slightly different to begin with.
That's so.
When you said the fathers don't tell the sons anything, so that could be taken as a protest, the fathers protest against the system, and that brings in the role of ideology. And the gentleman over here said, are you a socialist? Are you into destroying the whole superstructure, including the ideology of society, and changing it all?
Well, I'd like to talk about the topics I came here to talk about, and I think there are many people who'd like to. Excuse me, don't interrupt me. I didn't interrupt you, but it's typically male. Excuse me for you saying, seriously. I mean, you know, for you to say that, you know, in Europe things are all so different. Half the research. You're interrupting me again. I give up. You want to hear what I have to say, or don't you? I doubt you do.
Okay, let's take a question here, please.
One of the main problems, I think, is isn't it these sort of dualistic categorizations of masculinity and femininity, sort of challenging that?
Yeah.
I think that's a big problem.
Yeah.
Secondly, I'm very worried. Recent literature is, aren't men the real victims? I'm worried about the scapegoating of the mother. It's men who are oppressed.
Well, in any case, if I can answer this point,
right?
If I could answer this point, I'd be quite happy. And that is that, of course, I don't think it's so simple as to say that men are not benefiting from the system. Of course they're benefiting from it. But what I'm trying to do with my work, and have been trying to do for a long time, is to expose the core, give an x-ray for the system, if possible. I think that the system has been mystified in our eyes, so that we can't really see it clearly, although feminism has gone a long way to doing that. But still, of course, I mean, it's not complete. And so therefore, I just would like to add what I can to being able to x-ray it. Once you can see the system, once we can really name it exactly for how it happens, then I think that we've already created a possibility for another system. And what that is, I don't know the name of it, okay? I'm trying to work on it.
We need to we need to move on here.
I've never seen one do it yet.
Right, we'll get back to that point. Sylvia, please, and then here, and then here, and then there. Yeah, go ahead. Mm-hmm. Go on. Or shout.
Yeah. Oh, that's not true. I mean, I like for many people to read my works, but they're really dense reading. She says I'm writing for a popular audience. That's thanks to her over there. You see? She deserves the credit. She says some of the language is simple, but the ideas aren't. I'm just telling them to keep them abreast of what you're saying, because they're starting to walk out. Yes, I would like to change some of them. Probably I've been influenced by everybody, and it's all a grand mixture in my head. She's just saying from which feminists had I been influenced, and about which paradigm, because there are so many. There was a book of 20 years of my essays published last year called Women as Revolutionary Agents of Change. And I suppose in there is the crux of the theoretical underpinnings of my work. You know, I mean, that question about, you know, are you a socialist and that, I'm just trying to work towards what it is that we might be able to do. I'm very concerned with, of course, I think economics are important, but I'm very concerned with questions of, okay, well, if you don't want a patriarchy, what would it be? Oh, would it be a matriarchy? That's what everyone says, you know, to kind of taunt feminists or others that would like to change the system. I said before, the reason I think people ridicule those who want to change the system is because we believe that we're taught that it's silly to run away from home or it's silly to want to change things. I don't believe that's true. So what it is that we would have, I think there are two keys to that. One is prehistory, which we know very little about. But if you know the work of Marija Gimbutas, I think it's crucial to understanding ourselves, since it's trying to display a culture which was so extraordinarily different. It wasn't a matriarchy, it wasn't a patriarchy. What was it? Well, we don't have a name for it. But we're now, through the artifacts and all of that, trying to establish what they might have felt, believed, done, and thought. It's the same for my work. So for 20 years, I try to ask people how they feel compared to how they're supposed to feel about certain things in their lives. Through the books that I present 90% of the words are statements of other people, and those people argue and debate with each other on crucial issues such as what is love, is it passion or caring, etc. And then I sometimes join in and I say what I think it is or what I think it all means, what they've been saying. Through that, gradually, you can build up a picture of another way of life. It may not have a name. Somebody else can come along and start building on whatever it is that I'm documenting. But it's an interesting time to be documenting because people are making extraordinary changes in how they think, especially women, but maybe men, but especially women in how they think about things. To document that, to let people debate that, and then to draw out from that the theoretical parts, I hope will be a contribution. Yeah, it's the best right. I can do, I think.
Sorry, Sylvia, because there's
ask
here,
me later.
And then this lady here, and then this gentleman, and then there, and then there.
Could you please comment on the relationships between mother and son?
Just a comment on the relationships between mothers and sons. Mothers and daughters? I'm sorry, could you say?
I was thinking of mothers and sons and girlfriends or wives and sons, that kind of kind of.
Yes. Well, yes, and as I said, it's not a study done exactly with cultural comparisons in mind, but what I tried to do was to talk about the framework and then show how the framework that we have, the ideological framework, which can for the moment be cartoonized by saying the Holy Family framework, that is, these three people. Obviously, if one doesn't come from a Western country, it may not be as strong, especially India, of course, would have a different kind of a pantheon in front of it and therefore allow for more diverse personalities. In India, there are women goddesses who are, you know, negative life-giving and life-taking. So I think that that would be a better way that someone could imagine how to be a woman, rather than our model, which is just that you have to be loving. You always have to be there for the child and very speechless, honestly, and that you're not really a woman until you're married. So one of the most essential tasks, in fact, for a patriarchal society to remain in place is to disrupt the mother-daughter relationship, whether it's a blood relationship or whether it's just older women and younger women. You have to keep women apart and separated, because otherwise they'll be too powerful, because it's half of the world, after all. So part of the whole ridiculing of women by patriarchy is to keep women being second class, first of all, and to also keep them from being angry, because anger is the one thing that we cannot be, supposedly, because it's the worst thing you can be. She's smiling. And if, then there's all the competitions that are put in about looks and appearance and all of that. They're very complex topics. In fact, I try to kind of go against the usual thing that's said, is that women have to compete for men in patriarchy, so therefore we're always at odds. That's been said so often that I thought I would look at another area in my book this time, and I looked at the actual relationship between a mother and a daughter and came up with the thought that it's mighty peculiar that, well, first of all, menstruation, the beginning of menstruation, never gets celebrated. It's still something kind of a matter of, well, not shame exactly, but, you know, well, you shouldn't make a big deal of it. You should prove that you're above all of that. So, but there's never a discussion between a mother and a daughter such as, you know, can I see your vulva? I don't know how many holes I have. Excuse me for being very open about this, but I mean, those are the kind of things that kids might say to a mother in another world. They don't say it in our world. Mothers would feel that they were doing something very terrible if they would display their vulva to their daughter. And yet, why would that be terrible? Well, it goes back to all the stereotypes of our society about who women are supposed to be, about the shame of menstruation, the shame of our bodies, Eve's sin, all those kind of ideas are interrupting that relationship. So unless the two women are pretty much aware of the stereotypes, sometimes it's hard to get beyond them.
Right, so this gentleman here, and then there, and yeah. Then we're still...
Sorry, my answers are so long, I just don't know how to be shorter. He's saying that a British Psychological Society did a study which came up with statistics which showed that children from single-parent families are more disruptive in class on a couple of other very negative points. I don't know anything about the study. I don't know how big it was. I don't know whether the children were asked, whether the teachers were asked, whether the parents were asked. Would you care to tell me about that? I would like to see it, of course. I think that, you know, we're going to see lots of competing studies now about all of that. I have to say that some of the ones that I do know about are not from the British Psychological Association, but in fact sort of cooked up by one of the newspapers, which, you know, imports somebody from the States who really doesn't know much about England, takes them around to council flats and have them write up the story about that. So I'll be glad to tell you about that after. I just don't want to be quoted. I know all the names. So, you know, I mean, it's a highly political issue, as you know. Even if single mothers created some kind of children who were feisty, more feisty than others, and that's contrary to my research, I find the opposite. Even if, we still wouldn't have the right to deny women their rights.
Right. Do we get a question here, please?
Yeah, I'd like to ask you a question about your academic methodology.
Where are you? I can't find you. Oh, there you are.
Hi. Your academic methodology. It's been reported in the press, not just by men, but by women as well, that your academic methodology is severely lacking in rigor and discipline, to such an extent that some of your surveys, upon which I understand you based your reports, vague, and some of the methodologies upon which they're based are academically corrupt. Could it therefore be said, perhaps, in light of your speech, which, if you'll forgive me for saying, was just a collection of rather miscellaneous mishmash of anecdotes, rather than any serious analysis whatsoever?
You've done a lot of serious analysis, I can tell that. I'll tell you what, I'll take you. Go on. Continue the bashing, I love it.
The person in the room who merits the most congratulations, your publicist, and perhaps not yourself.
Well, that's really, really lovely, lovely statement. And I'll tell you what, if you've ever read one of my books, okay, then I'll take you out to dinner, because you never have. And these kind of things you're saying are based on press reports, which you can, repeat all day and all night, but there's nothing like actually reading a book. I don't care where you read it. It's been said hundreds of places. I would just like to say one thing anyway, that's, just for the record, and that is that, there are massive tests. I won an award for my research, actually, from the American Association of Sex Educators, Counselors, and Therapists, the largest such organization. I don't want to spar with you all night, but don't interrupt me, okay? I'll just answer you, because I listened patiently to you. And the point is, anyway, there are long methodological essays. There are lots of scholars quoted there who like my research. But I really think that until you've read it, we can't carry on a further conversation.
Right. This gentleman here, and then we'll take two more.
Maybe
there,
we can go
right
faster.
Back, yeah. Right.
I mean, I'm not
here
in a rush to leave. Unless you have to close the room, I can continue because I was late, so therefore.
Right. We're over there.
Well, the issue of methodology is quite complex, and it will take a lot of time to answer you. There's a long essay in the book which does explain all of this, but very briefly I will say the following, and that is there are two kinds of research, and one is qualitative and one is quantitative. Mine is a mixture. I've always wanted to have questionnaires in which the people responding were totally anonymous. No researchers do this. When they say that their participants are anonymous, that means that they don't tell the names of the people to the public. For example, if the Wellcome Society went and asked people on their doorstep, they knew the names of the people and their addresses. They didn't tell the public their names and addresses. Yes, so it's not the same as being anonymous. If you knock on somebody's door and you ask them something, like, are you gay? I mean, it's quite probable that many people will not say yes, even if they feel that they might be or are. So I've always wanted, in these areas of private life that I specialize in, to have people have the right to be anonymous. That involves a certain method of distribution. If you'll read a methodology textbook, which are very boring, you will find that for the kind of distribution I do, a 2.5% return is normal. So I get about a 3% return. I will now say something else quickly about so-called random samples, which are the other kind of sampling, in which case, of course, you know who the participants are. They can never be anonymous. A random sample is classically done by you open the phone book, you don't look, and you pick 19 people. Now, to have that sample truly be random, all 19 have to agree once you call them up and say, hi, I'm so-and-so, do you want to answer my questions? They all have to say yes. And if they don't, then you don't have a random sample. I belong to the American Association of Public Opinion Research, of which there's also a British division. And one of the officers there told me some years ago, and actually she's written an introduction to this couple of my books, that typically a researcher doing that kind of so-called random sample will get a 70%. Well, it's been decided within the field that if you get 70% of those people, of the 19, to respond, then you can still call it a random sample. In fact, most people are getting about 50% to respond because the public is getting bloody tired of all of these surveys. So, and I don't blame them. So if you have only a 50% response rate, you don't really have a random sample anymore. You're doing exactly what I do. You then, for the other 50%, have to go out and find, well, I need somebody who's old, I need somebody who's black, I need somebody who's something. You have to go and find them. Well, in a sense, then you've really not had a random sample. So methodology is a very, very complex topic. The newspapers use that figure to bash me with. And anyway, if you didn't agree with any of my statistics, there are still a lot of very interesting ideas in my books, and I hope that you'll find them so.
Right, okay. Here, and then the lady right at the back.
Yeah.
I'd like to know...
Where is she? I can't find anybody. Where is she? Oh, yeah. There. Hi. No, no, I couldn't see you.
What do you think of what I call, like, a culture of victory in feminism?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she's talking about that, you know, lately there's been a term called victim feminism. She was at Kent University. Pardon me for calling you she. Anyway, she was at Kent University, and there was a lot of discussion there about rape on campus. And I think, wasn't that the place where there was a discussion about who will take, wasn't it police who were going to take students home from events, female students home from events? And then that was seen as, well, you know, why do we need to have male chivalry? Was that the way it was said? Isn't that kind of antiquated? And how does all this line up with
women fighting for equality rather than being victims?
Yeah, she says, how does that, you know, shouldn't women fight for their equality rather than to be victims and to talk about the problems, i.e. women being battered and all of that? You know, I mean, if feminists for the last 20 years hadn't brought up the issues, of course we wouldn't be at the place we are now in the discussion. It's one thing to say now that, well, yes, you know, should we call people incest victims or incest survivors? Yes, of course we have the luxury to say that now that we've even defined the issue, but can you imagine how difficult and heroic it was for the first few people who stood up and said, yeah, well, this happened to me and my family. I know some of those women who wrote those books and said those things. Of course, when they're first said, it's like you stepped off the planet. You know, people were afraid that nobody would speak to them, that they would be shamed for life. I mean, if their father had been committing incest with them and they had gone along with it and not spoken up before, then of course they were terrified of how that would seem. So I don't think it really mattered in the beginning if somebody was portrayed as a victim or a heroine or what they were portrayed as. I think they did the right thing in speaking out. Those issues were hard enough to speak out in the beginning. Now we're here, now we can think about it in different ways. But to me, I mean, women are always getting bashed for something. So, you know, first women were bashed for being too masochistic and not speaking up, and now, you know, we're being bashed because we're not presenting it in the right way, or because, you know, one of us is too old, one of us is too young, one of us has hair too long, one of us wears no makeup, one does wear makeup. I mean, all these issues don't matter. These are all ways of distracting people from what women are actually trying to do. And, you know, I mean, victim feminism, I can only ever think, when I try to think about how strategy can be done, about the struggle that blacks have had and are still having in the United States. Since I come from there, I know that best. I mean, you may know some other struggle, but blacks in the United States went through for centuries of these kind of discussions. How do you get out of the situation you're in? And in the 19th century, there were black theorists who talked about moving back to Africa. There were black theorists who talked about making business networks kind of a nation within a nation. There have been feminists who talk about that. If we would support each other's businesses, then we could become so strong that we could make change. Or the suffragettes, of course, felt that we could all vote together and therefore change. I think we need all of these processes at the same time.
Right. Great, at the back, please.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. What was the last thing you said? Because it's a long way from there to here and a lot of rustling. I couldn't hear last. She's saying, why do women stay with men who are violent to them? Basically, that we're in the 90s and that this should all be in the past by now. Well, I think a lot of it is in the past. It's less in the sense of women as staying in bad situations. It's less than before. If you look at the divorce statistics, it's mostly women who are initiating divorce. And women were told that they were masochists to stay in them. They were staying in them because according to the Holy Family model, then you're only a good woman if you stay. Now that's the role that Back to Basics would try to reinsert into our world, including based on, cooked up statistics, pardon my saying it, to show that that children are just desperate when they're not in a dual parent family. Most women were finding that much as they might love a man, they just couldn't to work. The worst cases are the actual physical battering, but of course there's a lot of emotional battering too. Now that many women have left, not because they hate men, but because they just felt it would be healthier for them and the kids to leave, that, now we're getting bashed as being selfish single mothers who won't stay with our kids and that we should stay no matter what and we should work it out. Well, women have been trying to work it out for ages. That's why they stayed and took the battering. So I just don't think that the problem is with us. I think the problem is with men now thinking that there are other ways to be male than to be dominant, and there are other social systems besides patriarchy, and the opposite is in matriarchy, as they always say. So therefore, now we have to be really creative and go into the 21st century and, be adult and think up new things to do. That's what I think.
Right, now there are just two last questions here and here, and then we have to stop, I'm afraid. So you go.
Oh gosh, do I see motherhood and family as the root of women's oppression? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I sure remember in the early 70s women's movement that was a lot of what was said, and nobody was hissing at that point. If you say it today, it's, like you've committed some sort of horrible statement. But, of course, the family has been an oppressive institution to women. The family, as we've known it, has been oppressive to women, because it's always put women second class. It made women into the helper. We didn't even have souls in the Christian tradition for a long time. So therefore, we were just sort of there. There is no denial that it's been. And, actually, I'm now waiting on the Pope to apologize to women for all the burnings of women that were done during the Middle Ages. 500 years, more women were killed than during World War II, people were killed. And, when I see memorials to the Holocaust, I start thinking that, actually we should be making more of an issue of this, especially today as films like Fatal Attraction are run without much public awareness of what this leads to and what that's reminiscent of. Also those late night grade B horror films in which, women turn out to have fangs, you thought they were nice in the beginning, but then, that's just demonizing of women from the Middle Ages. It's only been two centuries since women were not burned. This burning of women, it's only been two centuries. That's not very long. It's the tradition of democracy and the Enlightenment, rationality, whatever that means, that brought along with it these ideas of human rights. And there really, some of the Back to Basics people would like to go back way, way back, about 400 years back, and I'm totally against that.
Right, last question here.
It's a question about penetrative and non-penetrative sex. Now, I read your first book, The Height Report,
very long time ago, and I remember enjoying it.
Thank you.
Not so much from the scientific analysis point of view, but just because I was a young woman reading about other people's sexual experiences. The thing about it is...
But you shouldn't be confused about the scientific analysis.
Sure.
I don't have any experts besides myself here to stand up for it, but you shouldn't be afraid to stand up for it, too.
Right. The thing that I think is interesting is that it seemed at the time you were saying women are not really sexually satisfied. And you said, I could be misreading you, but there was a general acceptance among feminists that there was an over preoccupation with penetrative sex and that non-penetrative sex would be equally rewarding and that this was something that was misunderstood. If you look today, I think that that argument is not really in any way providing women with any basis of sexual experimentation. It's actually become quite conservative. So if you look in Britain, the arguments around the safe sex campaign, the arguments about not needing to go all the way, which is very popular on campus, is in and of itself imposing a framework on young women which says sexual experimentation is dangerous. If you really are into penetrative sex, you're like men, you're base, mm-hmm. you're gross, and you're into rough part of sex, whereas women should be into the gentle and the more polite part of sexual relationship.
The more lovey, cozy stuff, right.
Right. I think that it is interesting. I think it's some of the points that Kate Rokeby alludes to in her book that's been published recently, mm-hmm. The Morning After, but she just indicates that what started out as being about widening women's sexual experiences today can be seen as quite puritanical and limiting of women's sexual experiences. I think she's making a very valid point.
Well, that point has been around. Could people up here hear it? Yes? No? Yeah. Well, that point has been around for ages. It's been this debate in feminism for a long time. There was a satirical... first of all, there was a feminist journal in the 70s, Off Our Backs, which, you know, clearly meant, you know. And then there was the answer to it. It was On Our Backs, you know. And that meant, you know, well, don't be so politically correct. We can enjoy all kinds of sex. And then there was this lesbian S&M magazine, which became extremely popular. And there are some of them here, too, in England now. And, you know, I mean, they celebrate the joys of rough sex and all that, right? So I don't think that it's correct when Katie Royfe, if she does say that feminism only had one line on sexuality. In fact, I think she'd be dead wrong. But it is a valid point that there shouldn't be just one line because we're all trying to figure out what it is we do like, and we're coming out of a culture that's been dominating us for 2,000 years, so much so that we couldn't even see it because it was so real that it made us think that there could never be another reality, or some of us anyway. So, but my first book, the basic argument there wasn't that maybe there were overtones of that penetration had been the only way that sex could be had because it was a reproductive model of sexuality, but that other ways sex could also be had. I think I was the first one to say that. But the basic point of my first book was that most women at that time were told that the only way to have a real orgasm was through with penetration, coitus. And Kinsey had known that most women needed clitoral stimulation. He said so in one sentence. He also said, as did everyone, women, they said, had a problem having orgasm. They said, we weren't as sexual as men because we didn't come as easily. That, therefore, well, that's just the way women are, it was said, and what can you do about it? Isn't it a shame? Then it was said that maybe we had a mental block, we should go to see an analyst and find out why we couldn't, as the phrase went, let ourselves go. So the climate into which Masters and Johnson did their reports, and which I did mine, was that one. So what my book was showing, that most women need actual some form of clitoral stimulation or pubic area or vulval exterior stimulation by hand or by mouth in order to have an orgasm. And, you know, I mean, others had concluded this, although not on the kind of research I did, but it was a stereotype in society. But the usual reaction was, isn't that a shame? Whereas I said, well, yeah, but if most women can have orgasm easily from masturbation or stimulation that's exterior, isn't that great? So most women don't have a problem having orgasm. It's just that the society has a problem accepting the way that women do have orgasm. So society should change its definition of sex, not that women have to change their anatomy. So, you know, That was the gist of it. I don't know how Katie Royce represents what I said in her book, but if she...
Right.
Well, I think, you know, that this whole issue of sexuality, I mean, I don't like bashing women altogether. I'm really tired of it. I think Hollywood movies continue the stereotype that sex is penetration and only penetration without a condom. It's never clitoral stimulation. You know, when I see those stereotypes change or when any sex video change, then I'll be ready to say, yes, of course, we've gone overboard the other direction. But until then, I don't think so.
Right. That seems like a very good place to stop. I'd like...
you know you're getting a laugh with that. You'll never live this long.
So, for those of you who would like to join us for a drink on the fifth floor, you're very welcome. Otherwise, it remains simply for me to thank Cher Height for a very provocative evening. Thank you.